This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. And we begin today with the shootings in New Zealand, where at least 49 people have been killed at two mosques in Christchurch, the largest city on the country's South Island. New Zealand's Prime Minister has called the tragedy a terrorist attack, and details continue to emerge, but so far police have charged one man with murder and two others are in custody. Muslims across the world are reacting to the tragedy, including those here in Greater Boston. Earlier today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh attended prayer services at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center to express his support and solidarity. Here he is speaking to those in attendance.
We pray with you. We cry with you. We support you. And we'll always continue to make sure that we do that as we move forward.
Imam Sheikh Yasser Fahmy just came from leading that worship service, and he joins us now on the line. Sheikh Yasser, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I know this has been a trying few hours for you here, but if you can, tell us a little bit about what your initial reaction was like when you heard the news.
Certainly, I think that it was absolute devastation. I mean, to hear and see and look at the sights and sounds that were just so traumatic and so painful. The faces that I saw online and those images are the faces that are so familiar to me. And to our community and the people that we see and that we pray alongside every day. And notwithstanding the fact that many people who are close to me in terms of friends from across the country have family members who are actually killed in New Zealand.
I mentioned the New Zealand Prime Minister is calling this a terrorist attack. Can you talk a little bit about how that phrase is resonating with you?
I think it's certainly helps in the healing process and in moving in a more constructive direction to address a lot of the pain and the suffering that we see in the world today. For too long, we have shied away from using this term when identifying people who come from this particular terrorist background and orientation. And too many people have suffered from different faith traditions and different races, whether black, white, or Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, or even Sikh, who have suffered at the hands of white supremacist terrorists, and that we are starting to see that language placed where it belongs, and that is in the public airwaves for the people to understand that this is a scourge that exists, and that people, and that we as a civilization, as human beings, as people, as nations, we have to be vigilant and mindful that this exists, and that this is a toxic ideology, that we have to come together and really in solidarity to address.
So today's Friday, which is basically the equivalent to the Sabbath for Muslims. Many were attending afternoon worship at the services when the attack happened. This is supposed to be obviously a safe space on a sacred day. Can you talk a little bit about what that disruption feels like and does to the community?
Well, it certainly is so painful and so traumatic and so real because of the fact that people are coming usually from work or school because we go to school, we go to work on Fridays in our countries, and then you have to kind of dip out and take a 30 to 1 hour break to pray and kind of reconnect with God in that moment. And people just kind of coming in, taking off their shoes, going into the carpeted area and praying. It's such a vulnerable and real human experience. And then to see images of people gunned down from behind like a video game when they were in that state, when they were in the state of prostration, literally just bowing to God. And, it really does make one feel profoundly vulnerable. On the same token, that coming into the sacred space and to see that people are today have come out not fearing, not cowering, but rather coming out in full force to be present, to pray and to worship and to continue to surrender to God and to pray with community members.
Yeah,
and with faith leaders and other clergy members.
You talk about that vulnerability. I want to play a little bit of tape here from Nihad Awad, the executive director of CARE, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations, from a press conference earlier this afternoon.
In the United States, we have over 3,000 mosques. So millions of people who are Muslim will be in mosques in the next couple of hours, concerned and fearful about their lives. If someone might come and hurt them, they have very legitimate fears.
And he went on to say, they want you to be afraid. Don't be afraid. Have you heard reactions from folks who are coming to worship?
I think what I've come to find in our community is because of the fact that, unfortunately, trauma is so regular. Here and far and wide, because we're a very international community. We have over 60 nationalities that attend every Friday. So we're a very international community, and we have people who are suffering and experience pain from all walks of life, from all across the world. People have become all too familiar with trauma and pain. But what we are seeing is that certainly fear is real, worry is real, concern is real. People are thoughtful and concerned about security and well-being and, are we safe? But on the same token, I see the strength and I see the resolve and I see the commitment. That people are not going to shy away. They're not going to stop coming to these sacred spaces, not going to stop coming to the mosque, because it is a place of worship, and it's a place where we come to be in communion with God and with other people from our community. And so I really do feel that our community members are worried, they're concerned, but they're strong in their resolve and their commitment to keep on going forward.
I'm wondering if you're feeling supported by the community here. We just spoke a little while ago with the imam of the mosque of the Islamic Society in Framingham, who said a group of Jewish people showed up at their worship service today to show their support. Are you feeling outreach from the community?
Absolutely. I mean, we have been showered with an outpouring of support and concern. First thing in the morning, I got a call from Mayor Walsh. I got a message, text message from Governor Charlie Baker, who reached out to me and, wished that he could have been. And he's supporting us. And obviously the police commissioner was with us today, and many faith leaders from all walks of life. We had over at least maybe I saw two dozen faith leaders with us from every tradition. So what Boston has really shown us over the years is that we are always together when trauma hits. Regardless, it doesn't matter where that trauma may hit, we will come together and we will be stronger together and we will support one another. And that is the spirit that I hope really pervades in this moment, that we are able to collectively rise above this and show the world that there's a different way of being, that hate and anger and aggression and toxic othering does not need to inform who we are and how we are with one another, that we are human beings and we're all connected to the same source. And we need to make sure that that's what the humanity at large really begins to internalize as a spirit.
Sheikh Yasser Fahmy is the senior imam at the Islamic Society of the Boston Cultural Center. Sheikh Yasser, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we continue to learn more about the attack in New Zealand, we want to take a look at the role of technology in publicizing these shootings. A gunman allegedly live-streamed a video of the attack on Facebook. Graphic footage that is believed to be part of the shooting could be found on Facebook and other social media sites hours after being posted, which is raising questions about the responsibility of social media sites to monitor content like this. And joining us now to talk more about that is Mason Marks. He's a research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute and a visiting fellow at Yale's Information Society Project. Mason, thanks for taking some time to talk with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So we know that Facebook, generally speaking, looks out for violent and graphic content, incidents like this, also suicides or people expressing suicidal thoughts. Can you talk to us first, kind of generally, how Facebook goes about identifying this content? What does it look for?
Yeah, so graphic violence is clearly against Facebook's policies, but actually detecting and preventing that graphic violence imagery from spreading is really a very large and complex technical problem. So if you think about the size of Facebook, the company has over 2.2 billion users worldwide. There are millions of messages posted per minute and billions of messages posted per day. And Facebook does have human content moderators that can review images and posts for graphic content. But there are certain limitations. There's only a limited number of human content moderators, and that's a very, very difficult job. It's been reported that it can be very traumatic for the people who do it. And partially for that reason, Facebook is using artificial intelligence to identify the content of posts and images. But there are real limitations to the effectiveness of that AI. So Facebook is training it on very large databases of billions of images from Instagram, for example. and they could theoretically train it to identify a gun or some other evidence of violence. But the problem is so large, if you think about the sheer volume of messages on the platform, and the AI just isn't really advanced enough to detect it quickly and accurately enough, that it really isn't realistic, at least right now, given the size and the state of the technology, to expect Facebook to be able to react as quickly and effectively as we might like it to.
So, as I mentioned, this footage was out there for hours. If it's not possible with the current systems, what would sites like Facebook need in order to get footage like this down sooner?
Yeah, so I mean, part of the problem is that the internet is set up to allow people to share information very quickly and easily. So even if Facebook was to react much more quickly than it did, people could easily download the video and stream it on other sites like YouTube and Twitter, and in fact, that's what did happen. Now, I did see some recommendations today for what Facebook might have been able to do better, and they range from potentially just shutting down the site entirely for a period of time, or potentially blocking new videos from being uploaded, and perhaps screening for certain search terms, but that could be effective. The problem there is that we might shut down the spread of legitimate news, and people do use social media like Facebook and Twitter to receive news these days. So we have to balance the effectiveness of preventing people from seeing the violence with also sharing legitimate news about the event, which is important.
Yeah, how do you see that balance? Do you think that Facebook should have more control over this kind of thing, or do you think that the risks basically outweigh the potential gain?
So I do think when it comes to preventing suicide and preventing violence and terrorism, Facebook is doing is trying to do the best that it can. And I think it should be doing something. The problem that I really have is with the degree of transparency that Facebook has surrounding its content moderation. So you mentioned detecting suicide using AI, and Facebook basically scans all user-generated content on the site for signs of what Facebook believes is suicidal thought or behavior. And then Facebook will actually send police to people's homes if the risk is thought to be very high. They actually assign a score from 0 to 1 to these pieces of content, where a score closer to 1 reflects a higher risk of suicide. And Facebook has expressed interest in using that type of technology in other areas. So conceivably, they could use it for violence, for example. They could assign a score from 0 to 1 to an image or a post reflecting the risk that that person might be a violent threat. But that concerns me a bit, because we have to question how much we want Facebook to take on the role of a law enforcement agency. And Facebook does call 911 in response to high-risk suicide posts, and it will actually help police locate users. And in many cases, police might be able to search a user's home just based on the report that Facebook has provided. So there's potential for people's civil rights to be curtailed based on information that Facebook provides. And Facebook is not very transparent. They don't have the degree of transparency that we expect from law enforcement. So if that starts branching out into other areas like preventing terrorism, preventing violence, I have a real concern that people could ending up perhaps with violent confrontations with police, or having their homes searched without probable cause, just based on sort of a very non-transparent, opaque AI system that we don't really know the effectiveness of.
Yeah, Facebook's response to these types of things in the past has basically been along the lines of, we offer the platform, you know, the content is not ours, that they, as you said, they don't have the resources to monitor it. But this is a multi-billion-dollar type business. What's the responsibility there? This is obviously a video that the alleged shooter wanted out there, and Facebook obviously gave a platform for that. What's the responsibility you think that this company holds?
That's a good question. It's a very difficult question. In the U.S., at least, social media platforms are often shielded from liability by a law called the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which treats them not so much as publishers of information. So they're generally shielded from a lot of liability. There have been discussions of changing that. I know in some other countries, there have been some groups from Israel that have filed lawsuits against Facebook for promoting terrorist messages. And it's a really difficult question. I mean, there is a balance there. If we were to make Facebook responsible for every piece of violent content, then it would effectively, you know, cease to be able to function. And so I'm not sure I have an answer for that right now, but it's something we need to be thinking about more and more.
Yeah, I think as a society, you know, you think about folks who are just maybe scrolling through their news feeds and happen to see some graphic or disturbing imagery or video. This stuff is so widely available and easily distributed. How are you thinking about that kind of availability?
I think that clearly we don't want a lot of people who might be vulnerable, like children, seeing really graphic violence on social media. But at the same time, we do have a real problem with violent content in film and music and other forms of media. And people have been trying to study the link between seeing violence on in media or in a video game and linking that to violence in the real world. And so far, there hasn't been a really, really strong scientific evidence of that connection. Some studies have come out saying there has been an increase in aggression in children, but there was just a study that came out last month out of Oxford, and they argued that there was no connection there. So though clearly I think it's important to do the best we can to prevent this type of graphic imagery from spreading, but at the same time, we don't really have clear, strong evidence that it does result in violent behavior.
Mason Marks is a research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute and a visiting fellow at Yale's Information Society Project. Mason, thanks for the time.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll get analysis of the news, week of the news, from our Week in Review panelists. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.